Well, I'll be telling you. The Horn is listener-supported radio. You have made certain that the Horn is able to go forward for nearly 7 years now. Hard to believe, isn't it?
I know.
But for nearly 7 years, you've kept all of this going. We started a little discussion last night about fundraising, so I want to share the latest bit of input we got. An email coming in from Taiwan from our buddy Horst, who really laid out the case quite nicely. The response has been almost unanimous as to continuing the fundraising and trying to get a little bit ahead, even though we have met September's goal. Here is what... thanks, Jim. You sure talk pretty for a hillbilly. Jim's in rare form tonight. Thank you, Jim. Our buddy Horst wrote in. He said, as usual, I'm entering this conversation a little late, but I'm happy to give my two bits. If you don't listen to anybody else worth listening to in this business of liberal talk radio, you'll notice that the self-employed ones don't let a day go by without a significant reminder as to the importance of listener contributions. Whenever you mention getting pushback from listeners about pitches, I assume these are people accustomed to listening to terrestrial radio hosts like Tom Hartman and Randy Rhodes, both of whom are examples of liberal progressive hosts able to operate successfully in a standard radio model involving corporations' paychecks and staff paid with their own paychecks. It amazes me when you get flamed occasionally by people for missing shows, not having substitute hosts, or having to remind the listeners that we all have a stake in the success or failure of this enterprise, so aptly described as conversation radio. In a sense, you kind of have to take it as a compliment, Bob. You take an extremely complicated juggling act and make it appear so effortless that some listeners are fooled into thinking that running a radio program really is a simple matter that anybody could do, pull off, if they only wanted to badly enough. They have no idea how much work goes into a single hour of programming and support contributed by unpaid yet uncomplaining workers like John Fox, Ben Birch, and the litany of Horn stalwarts that make it all possible and to whom your daily thanks are unfailingly spoken at the end of each show. So for my two bits, I'd be politely grateful and forgiving toward these otherwise clueless listeners, but when it's over with, I wouldn't take the criticisms to heart, much less allow them to affect my course of going forward. It's just not realistic. Horst then notes a couple of examples of other folks who are operating independently and struggling to survive. He says, look at Sam Cedar. He operates on a subscription model of a minimum of $10 a month, does promotions with paid sponsors, and still has to flog the listener support issue every single broadcast. Look at Malloy. He actually has some terrestrial coverage. He sells podcast subscriptions. He has commercial sponsors, and he had that brilliant idea of show sponsorships. And he still has to beat the drum every few shows to keep the wolf away from the door. And unlike you, he only has one kid in the house, who thankfully appears to have all her internal organs functioning normally, and thus requiring no expensive trips to the doctor for checkups and surgeries that no child should ever need. Amen to that last. Look at all the great radio personalities, Horst adds, and shows that folded due to lack of support. You know the names. I know the names. To borrow a trope from the immortal Bart Cop, Bob Dole knows the names. And the American people know the names. There are too many to list. By the way, Bart Cop mentioned in a recent issue that he may be going dark in 2013, too. Oh, please, no, not Bart Cop. Horst says, if I ever win the lottery or become a famous and well-compensated media personality, you can bet that I'll be there to fund the liberal blogosphere and internet radio. But I wouldn't hitch your wagon to my star if I were you. Page 3 of my resume is the lyric sheet from Born Under a Bad Sign. Damn, I'm going to have to change my resume. I had that. And we'll change that to It Sucks to Be Me for mine. It sucks to be me. No. In the meantime, you're best served by getting comfortable with a daily, however brief, reminder to the listeners as to where all this comes from. Not to mention, you're not just a radio host, you're also a human rights activist with obligations that don't always conform to a daily broadcast schedule, which means there are going to be lean times that need to be compensated by the occasions such as this when the basic operating funds have been found. You can't afford to take a day off, in other words, even when things are going smoothly. Here's a final observation on the subject, Horst says. I sent you a contribution earlier today thinking you'd already met the September goals. I hadn't listened to today's podcast yet. I assumed that the goal had already been met because the last time several shows ago that I heard you mention fundraising or contributions or call it what you will, things were more than well on track to meet or exceed the goal with more than a week to go before month's end. And then when 2 to 3 shows went by last week without a single word on the subject from you, I assumed automatically that the goal had been met and you were doing as you had done the last time that happened, January or February, and simply staying silent on the matter without any fanfare whatever. Look at it this way. I gather it's kind of taboo to talk about how many listeners a show has. It's not taboo, Horst. I just don't know. That goes way back to a story I told about being caught peeking out from behind the curtain before a play one time, and my director saying, if I ever catch you doing that again, you will never be on the boards in a program I direct ever. Because it doesn't matter how many people are out there, you owe them the same degree of diligence and dedication if there's one or 1,000 or 10,000. But no, it is a significant number. Ben mentioned it one time. It's decent. But Horst says, assuming the Horn has 2,500 listeners, and we do, that means it would each take them $1 a month to keep the show operating. Now, some of us can't afford to send any money every month, and some of us don't have the ready means to get it there, and some of us are fortunate enough to be able to send more than that on a fairly regular basis. Ideally, it all works out on a monthly balance. But how would it change this picture if 2,500 listeners pledged to contribute $10 once every 10 months or $5 every 5? I bet a lot of your listeners that usually find themselves unable to contribute to the show could find a way to make that happen. It's a matter of perspective. Short story. Keep those reminders coming. I understand it irks, it rankles, it rubs against the grain to be in a position to have to ask people for money even when it's fairly owed, but you have to remind yourself you're not begging or scrounging, rather you're providing a service, much-needed relief and entertainment, a space for minds to meet, a community, a collective entity, the sum of which far exceeds the individual value that we contribute as members. And that has value, real value, and while you have the decency and generosity to offer that value to others with no strings attached, the reality has to be faced that nothing comes from nothing, and any time you make anything of value, sooner or later the bill comes around and it has to be paid, period. Can't be apologetic about this. It's simply reality. Horst continues, sometimes I hear guilt and self-reproach and maybe even shame in your voice when you have to bring the subject of funding up, and it's so undeserved and so misplaced I can hardly stand it. I know where it comes from, Bob. I was raised to starve first before begging, but this is not that. It ain't charity for us to contribute our fair share as we're able. There is a tremendous difference between asking for a handout and presenting a fair bill for services rendered, while of course being jovial and genial and entertaining about it as your chosen profession demands. I'll be happiest when you can bring up the fundraising subject with every show effectively and without apology. Okay, then. I think I've said as much as I could, and maybe more than I should. I hope you'll pardon me here. I'm not at my best at the moment, but I've had this subject on my mind for a good long time now, and I guess this was a good opportunity to hold forth on it a bit. Your pal, Horst. So much of that is about as well said as it could possibly be said. Thank you. Thank you very much. So there it stands. We will try to continue and get a leg up on October so that maybe in late October we're getting a leg up on November. Slowly but surely, maybe we can make this a little bit more sustainable than it is. That's the hope. That's the hope. Thank you very kindly for the contribution that just rolled in. It all helps. Every bit of it helps. Thank you. Now, that having been said, the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, and for those of you who don't like the PayPal button, and I understand, you can always go to headonradionetwork.com. The tab is Contribute, and you can find the snail mail address there. I'll repeat it now. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower, just like the President, Drive, PMB, Personal Mailbox, 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, West Virginia, 25801. And remember, when you do contribute to the Horn by snail mail, don't make checks or money orders out to Bob Kincaid. Bob Kincaid doesn't get them. Bob Kincaid doesn't endorse them. Boss Man Wayne sends them to the bank, where they go into the general fund every month to keep the plates spinning and the bells clanging and the whistles whistling. Again, thank you. Now, as I said, howdy, unclean things. You know, it is. It's Wednesday night. It's prayer meeting night. I will forego the shtick and the song simply because, well, this is just too icky. I don't feel like talking about being the Uber rabbi and the Archie mom and the animated animus tonight. This is just gross. You know, we all have our fascinations. And for some people, it's football. Others, it's NASCAR. Some people read, and then when it comes to reading, some people read hard-boiled detective fiction from the 30s and 20s and 40s. I do that. Other people read Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys. Some folks like Carl Hiaasen, the Barbara Cartland. I mean, you name it. There's all kinds of things that we take to divert ourselves when the world is too much with us. And I can be sucked into religious studies like a mark walking down the midway at a county fair. I mean, just pulled right in. So I forget what exactly it was last night that led me to click a link that opened up something at a webpage called Ask a Mormon. Now, before I say a blessed word about this, understand I don't care what anybody believes or doesn't believe. I generally fall into the doesn't believe category. I've found over the course of my life thus far that believing things gets more people into more trouble than just about any other verb in the English language. It's what happens when you stop thinking and let your heart or your emotions or whatever take over. But so it was that I clicked the link, and off down the rabbit hole of Ask a Mormon I went. Sheesh. And I found myself getting a little bit furious. I don't like snobbery of any sort. I'm not snobbish about what I do and don't believe. And I wish all faiths well with their imaginary friends. I don't think one faith is more barbaric than another. Christianity can go drop for drop and pint for pint and river of blood for river of blood with any other sect on the planet. Down in the New York subways recently, that weird, sick, right-wing freak, Pamela Geller, who is a devotee both of right-wing politics and Ayn Rand, etc., etc., etc. Her group paid for a series of ads in the subway that were based upon comments made by Ayn Rand. You know, that creepy old lady who deplored moochers but signed up for Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and whatever else she could get her hands on when she got old at the first opportunity she could get. Right. In other words, that hypocrite, Ayn Rand. If you're going to bitch about it, don't accept it. On the other hand, if you support the idea of government taking care of the needs of the people, because we are the government. That, you know, I hate all of this. Well, I created a generation of people dependent on government, as if government was something separate from us. You see these right-wingers, these teabaggers, these militia freaks, these Republicans, they are unable to conceptualize the idea of popular government, of self-government. And instead, in order to advance their sick political ends, they have to paint a portrait of the government as the other, as them, as somebody else. When in fact, the government are you and me, and us and we. But anyway, Pamela Geller, this hideous beast, paid for a bunch of ads to go up in those little rectangular poster spaces on the walls of 10 New York subway stations. And the quote that they used for the ad was a paraphrasing of Ayn Rand from something that she said in an interview long, 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 long ago in on Phil Donahue's program, in which she lauded... Now we know where the idea came from when Bishop Willard went babbling along in Israel about the superiority of Israeli culture over Palestinian culture. She said, in a war between a civilized man and the savage, support the civilized man. And that's what these pro-Israeli, pro-war posters said that have been plastered all over in 10 of the subway stations in New York City. I think one of them's at Times Square, but I don't know the layout of New York City well enough to tell you. But the story's out there. And this is a beautiful moment of free speech. Because people met those posters of bigotry by plastering over them stickers of their own that say things like hate speech and racist. The same thing was ultimately the result of a bus ad campaign in San Francisco as well, with a similar motto. They are racists, these right-wingers. Jim, expanding upon what I just said about government, said government is designed... Our government, I suppose I could safely say, is designed for the governed collectively to be able to do that which cannot be accomplished individually, i.e. a responsible, humane doctrine. Precisely. But it was a good thing to see racist and hate speech plastered over the palavering of these warmongers with their fangs dripping blood. Pamela Geller wants to see her a war, but she damn sure don't want to fight in it. Nope. Let's you and him fight. That's her position. Let's send some hillbilly kid off to die calling for his or her mother in the middle of some Iranian waste. Sure, why not? Let's let some kid from South Central go die in Iran so Bibi Netanyahu can be comfortably well off in some suite in Tel Aviv. Sure, why not? But I sort of digress from my initial point. That happens around here, sorry. And that is this. I went wandering off down the religion rabbit hole. And I found this little passage at this thing called Ask a Mormon about why it is that we, you know, the great unwashed hoi polloi, can't so much as attend a Mormon wedding if our best friend friends happen to be Mormons and happen to be getting married. Oh, no! You, me, us, we can't be going to no sealing ceremony in no Mormon temple. Mm-mm. No, baby, no. Bad. Bad infidel. Bad heathen. Bad. You know why? And you're just going to love, love, love this. Here we go. From Ask a Mormon. The question, why are Mormons not allowed into the temple? Why are non-Mormons not allowed into the temple? Temples, answer, temples are considered houses of the Lord, places we can go to commune with God, and no unclean thing can enter into the presence of God. So we preserve the sanctity of the house of God by certifying through local bishops, that people entering in are obeying God's commandments and living in such a way that they will not offend the Holy Spirit in the temple. You got that, you unclean things? You're not fit to walk into their pile of bricks because their imaginary friend lives in there. Now, I don't know if it's back behind the altar or under the couch or who knows. Come out wherever you God. The Willard of Oz says, go away. Right? Isn't that disgusting?
Oh, sure, Bob, but they've got a right to exclude whoever they want to.
Absolutely. And I've got a right to find that elitist and sickening. You know, some temple ordinances take hours, and nobody's just an observer. Everybody participates. I read that, too. You know, this is when they're, making secret high signs at each other and, you know, kind of, No. Don't make it so we can see it. Just do it down here low. I'll recognize you. Just give me the sign. You know, when you get to be a 32nd degree noble bishop or whatever it is. Who knows what they do in there and who cares? But it is disturbing to know that there is a man running for the presidency of the United States who feels that most of this country is not fit to enter his temple because we are unclean things. You ever read the Bible? Because I have. There was laws back then about, say, you know, you got the leprosy, so everywhere you went, you had to wander around screaming, unclean! 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 Somebody's about to bump up against you in the bazaar. Unclean! You know, because if they accidentally touched you, then they'd have to go to the temple and put their foot in a bucket and sing. Unclean things. See, this is why I reject concepts like original sin. This is why I don't think there really is a loving God who has prepared an eternal burning hell for the creatures that he made that he loves so much and that he's willing to fry because when the kid turned 13 one day, he filched a quarter for an ice cream cone. You're gonna fry for all eternity! I don't buy that crap. I think doing things that harm others, doing things that make other people sad, doing things that make other people suffer. If there's a hell out there, those are the people who are going there. If there's a hell out there, for instance, Kevin Crutchfield of Alpha Natural Resources is going there because he is to some degree or another, in at least in part, responsible for something on the order of 4,000 excess deaths in mountaintop removal communities every year. Because those 4,000 excess deaths wouldn't happen if mountaintop removal wasn't taking place in those communities. And mountaintop removal is taking place in those communities at the sponsorship of Alpha, which absorbed Massey. Don Blankenship has, for instance, has a red-hot poker waiting for his butt to be rammed all the way through and out of his mouth and put on the and hung over the fire so little demons can barbecue him for all eternity. Baste him a little more, son.
Thanks, Daddy. I will. The butter or the garlic?
Both. Delicious with sweet taters, roasting in the coals. Right? Yeah. But you can't enter the Holy of Holies. No siree. You're not good enough. Jim asking, these folks are a derivative of the Children of the Corn outfit? Hey, you could say that. But again, as I've pointed out, what Joseph Smith did when he was working his hustle is he put the man read a bunch of stuff. He was obviously very literate and very intelligent. It's clear that he read the Quran. It's clear that he read the Old and the New Testaments. It may also be clear that he even read some of the extant stuff. It's obvious that he was aware of some of the extant theorizing about the nature of the Americas prior to the arrival of Columbus. Yeah, see, Ron and Raleigh's got that question going now. Well, excuse me. I shower on a regular basis. What else can I do to ensure my cleanliness? Ron, you got the wrong underwear. Marty noting, like the Mormons are so April fresh. Manly, yes, but I like it too. Ray pointing out, Mormons believe nothing more rational than those who believe in the tooth fairy. They just have better lawyers. Of course, you can say that about most organized religion. The vast majority of slaughter over the history of the people of humanity has, at some time or another, had a direct relationship to somebody saying that their invisible friend told them to do it. At least Flip Wilson had the honesty of, the devil made me do it. Devil's busy, you know. But Smith was accomplished, and he put together his dodge with, if not real the real brains, then certainly real panache. Because when I went wandering off down the Ask a Mormon rabbit hole, oh boy, there's a bunch of fun stuff to read over there. Some of it will make you laugh so hard your belly will hurt. Let's see, what are some of the topics? Why do Mormons prohibit drinking alcohol? Why no coffee or near beer? Do Mormons date non-Mormons? Do Mormons believe that non-Mormons go to heaven? Well, only if they've been properly baptized after death. Can you define hot drinks? Latest questions. Exorcism, African Americans in the priesthood, medical marijuana, abortions in the past. Can a senior citizen become a Mormon? Roadside memorials. Opportunity after death. Mental retardation and severe disabilities. And then there was this. Where is the archaeological proof? Because you know I loves me some archaeology, right? Where is the archaeological proof of the Book of Mormon Wars? And that's a good question. And since it was such a good question, where is the archaeological proof of the Book of Mormon wars? Because the Book of Mormon's got all this data, all these allegations about all these wars that were taking place all over the Americas, battles with hundreds of thousands of people perishing in them. So rather than cogitate on that by myself, one of the beautiful things is when you've got a volunteer staff, no kidding, really honest-to-God archaeologist among you, as we do. So I sent that link about where's the archaeological proof of the Mormon Wars off to, you know, Dr. John. Because I said, I can't sit here and scream by myself, because the answer to that question, anyway, my question is, what do you think? From what you read here, where should I go from here and how should I get there? I'm just thinking input from somebody else may help me figure this whole thing out. Not an easy question, I know. Because, you know, the question talks about the fact that there's no damn data to support any of this stuff that Joseph Smith made up. And the first answer is, if you have not seen evidence, you must not have studied too much. I have a bachelor's in archaeology and a master's in Mesoamerican warfare, and the academic world is full of evidence for not only warfare, but Book of Mormon cultures. Now, our buddy Dr. John is a real live, honest-to-goodness the Ph.D., and he knows him some archaeology. He's teaching that to young students, as a matter of fact. So I sent it along to John, and Dr. John wrote back, and it kind of had that flavor of, damn you, Bob Kincaid, you've done it again. Okay, you've wrecked me for the day with this. I've already gotten immersed in Mormon message boards and wiki pages on archaeology in the Book of Mormon, and I'm studying CVs of faculty in the BYU anthropology department. No, really. So John said he'd try to pull something together, and pull something together he did. It takes two forms. He said, I'll lead with some suggestions in prayer meeting talk and then go through my impressions after spending way too damn long in this black hole of half-baked history. I'm sorry, Dr. John. I'm sorry. But some of this stuff we just can't do alone. From the moment you learn how to swim, you're always taught the buddy system. Don't go to the pool by yourself because, you know, there's a risk of you winding up looking like William Holden at the end of, you know, Sunset Boulevard. Yeah, face down in the pool. Don't do that. So on trips into half-baked history, I like to take a buddy with me, the buddy system. So he says, "Glory, Bob! So gratifying to see some real holy men taking that demonic Columbian exchange to task for what it is." A snare of the devil himself, meant to confound and confuse the believers. Straight from the temple, the one on the Great Salt Lake, we get proof, proof, I tell you, that everything those secular humanist archaeologists try to tell us is wrong. They say the Indians didn't grow silk or plant olive trees or drive chariots. They say there weren't no oxen or horses around to even pull them chariots. They say the Indians couldn't eat wild pigs or make swords out of iron and steel. They try to trot out so-called DNA evidence. You know, DNA, of course, stands for the devil's nucleic acid. And prove that the Indians are not related to the Jews. Huh. Well, finally, we learn the truth. It comes to us from the Mormon archaeologists who say it's certain that all those things, in fact, were here before Columbus. And if you doubt it, just read their papers and books. All of them funded by the Mormon Church, the only true godly source of funding. Not like that National Science Foundation, which is only run by a Kenyan Muslim socialist who wouldn't know the truth if it was tattooed on his arm just below the portrait of Malcolm X. That last one got me. I just had this visual of Michelle going, Barack, Barack. your portrait of Malcolm's fading, Barack. You need to go to the tat parlor and get it touched up a little bit. Having him turn around. Well, you know, that's okay, Michelle. Your Angela Davis isn't looking too good either. We'll go together next Saturday. But then, putting on his serious hat, Dr. John says, at your suggestion, Bob. Don't you love how he uses the word suggestion? Actually, the first email went something like this. Ever seen one of those cartoons where the drunk takes a look at something utterly ridiculous, takes out the flask from his inner into the jacket pocket, and just chucks it into the gutter? Yeah, this is one of those. Did you know that the academic world is full of evidence for not only warfare, but Book of Mormon cultures? Yeah, that was the suggestion. I feel really guilty. I feel like I've stolen some precious finite time from Dr. John. But God, somebody's gotta. And so, taking off his not-so-serious hat and putting on his serious hat, Dr. John said, at your suggestion, I've spent a couple of hours wading into the world of Mormon archaeology. It's a surprisingly complex and focused world with a very distinct two-front agenda. Let me say up front that I don't care what any particular faith teaches its own people about their origins. You know, like on the ark, which one of Noah's sons was in charge of feeding the tsetse flies? And what kind of miracle was it that allowed Noah to figure out which one was the male and which one was the female tsetse fly? You know? John continues, a religion's internal transcript is not my business. Hear, hear! On board. Everybody, I'm sure, is. But when a religion starts to step into my little corner of history and archaeology, I get worried, Dr. John says. The Mormons are enthusiastic spreaders of their faith, and the interweb tubes are full of so-called archaeological evidence that their story is way truer than other religions. Well, it's so true, they have to maintain a clean room where, you know, none of us filthy, unclean things can enter. You know, other faiths have tried that sanctum sanctorum thing from time to time. It has not worked out well. I mean, I don't want to go march around the... You know, only a good Muslim can go march around the Kaaba. Good for them. Enjoy. It must be a hugely satisfying moment to make the pilgrimage that the Prophet said that it is the duty of all good Muslims to make at least once in their lives. It's kind of like a Roman Catholic going to St. Peter's. Or certain shrines in India. Or Japan. Or the sacred spaces of native peoples the world over. But John says, you know, the Mormons are enthusiastic spreaders of their faith. And the interweb tubes are full of so-called archaeological evidence that their story is way truer than other religions. You do know that when Jesus comes back, he's not coming to Jerusalem, right? He's coming to Branson, Missouri, or somewhere. Isn't that going to be a little tough for him to do the whole put all the Jews to the sword thing in Branson? Just saying. This stuff is my business, Dr. John says, so I felt the need to comment. The first part of the Mormon archaeology agenda is about linking places mentioned in the Book of Mormon with physical locations in the modern world. This reads very much like a little subfield of my own discipline called biblical archaeology. The point is to find evidence that matches events and places in the Bible and then see how well the archaeological record fits or doesn't fit with the biblical one. On the surface, that sounds a bit suspect, and much of the work is. But there are certainly people of good professional standing doing good archaeology in that region and time period. You can easily tell the legit folks from the frauds. The former publish in peer-reviewed journals, which means other scholars read your work and agree that it's rigorous enough to publish. And they cite both people who agree with their interpretations and those who don't. The frauds don't do this. They publish in places that either are not peer-reviewed or in places whose peer reviewers have a clear agenda. The Discovery Institute, which fronts a lot of creation science, works along these lines and is an example of what he's talking about. This geographical approach doesn't seem all that convincing, and the sites I've been reading concede to that. They're all very much more interested in talking about the second part of the agenda, which is proving that specific things mentioned in the Book of Mormon were present in the New World before Columbus when the events described in the text were occurring. And this is where when you believe any holy text with all of its, so-called holy, with all of its mumbo-jumbo and miracles, whether it be Muhammad on some flying horse or the sun standing still in the sky, which means that the sun actually rotates around the earth, just saying, that's in the Old Testament, or zombies getting up from the dead and walking around, New Testament, or the Hindu cosmology of the world being held on the shoulders of an elephant which is standing on a turtle, 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 and it's turtles all the way down. All of those things they all require you to believe things that you wouldn't in everyday life. They require what Samuel Taylor Coleridge, working the poetry end of the street, referred to as the willing suspension of disbelief. If you're settling into something that's telling you some fantastic tale, you willingly suspend disbelief. It's sort of the same thing that was going on in the earliest days of the Greek theater, when even though you knew you were sitting in a theater and you knew those were actors wearing masks, you suspended your disbelief enough to really believe that that was Oedipus, that that is Oedipus up there, and he really is going off stage and going to use Yocasta's brooch to gouge out his own eyes because he's just realized the manifest sin that he's brought upon the people of Thebes by getting down in a rutting on Yocasta when Yocasta turns out to have been his mommy. Willing suspension of disbelief. But it's one thing to do that for literary purposes. It is another to base one's entire existence on it. And so it's especially the case with the Book of Mormon. Really, you have to, look at it this way. Remember the soundbite from last night? Remember those Scott Brown staffers who were hooping and hollering, doing the Indian mockery and the, the tomahawk chop like they were at a Braves game or a Florida State game? Well, first of all, the head chief of the Cherokee people spoke up today and said it was disgusting. Good for him. Glad he did. But the other thing that Scott Brown needs to bear in mind is that according to his party's nominee for the presidency, what they were actually mocking were Jews. Really, don't blame me. The Book of Mormon says that all the Indians are remnants of the lost tribes of Israel. No, really. Joseph Smith kind of had a hard-on for Jewish people from the very beginning, making the Indians into lost Jews who had lost their civilization, and then, 100 years later, they're proxy-baptizing people who were murdered in the Holocaust. A pattern begins to emerge. But these archaeologists, getting back to what Dr. John wrote, these archaeologists, so-called, are much more interested in proving that things that are mentioned in the Book of Mormon actually were present in the New World before Columbus when the events described in the text were occurring at some point in the distant past that we're not entirely certain about. But because they are placed in the context of a flight away from oldie, merry oldie Israel. Well, we know when that dates, and we're talking about sometime around, what, between 500 and 1,000 before the Common Era, right? So, in other words, we would be talking about a time in pre-Columbian New World prehistory when all the archaeological data says that civilization really hadn't quite got rolling yet. I mean, there were people doing good stuff, but, I mean, there were folks, for instance, the cultivating the first, and had been, maize and beans, the corn, bean, squash agriculture upon which the entire the dynamic arose. Quite possibly the most successful food system ever to appear on the planet, proof being the fact that just about the entire planet now eats that diet and drinks that diet. The great writer Michael Pollan having noted that the American people, for instance, consume a diet composed at its most essential levels of diesel fuel and corn syrup. But that's the context in which these Mormon wars took place. About between 500 and 1,000 of the current, before the current Common Era, current era. Dr. John continues, since I've been extemporizing. You mentioned the Columbian Exchange before, and presented that excellent talk with Charles C. Mann, the author of 1493 and 1491. The exchange refers to the movement of plants, animals, and people between the Old and New Worlds that started after European colonization. Before then, New World crops like peppers and tomatoes and maize, corn, beans, squash, didn't exist in the Old World, and Old World crops like rye and okra didn't exist in the New World. And there were no pigs or horses on this side of the Atlantic. The New World also didn't have bronze or iron working, at least in any real sense, although the Tarascan culture of West Central Mexico had apparently developed bronze, but they hadn't taken it to the point that it becomes an entire cultural flourishing. At least, and certainly not what's now in what's now the U.S. No known, and let's underline this, no known native New World cultures had draft animals or wheeled vehicles. There are evidences of wheeled toys in many places, but that's it. Native peoples before the arrival of Columbus knew the wheel. There just wasn't a hell of a lot to do with it, because there were no draft animals. The biggest possible draft animal was the llama. And that was limited to the Andean highlands. What's going to pull the cart? A capybara from the lowlands of Venezuela? I don't think so. The bison was undomesticatable. Sorry, lost a syllable there somewhere. But Dr. John continues, he says, in short, this second thrust of Mormon archaeology is dedicated to showing that all we know about the Columbian Exchange is bunk. Generations of science are simply wrong. Generations of scholarly research just don't matter, don't count, no matter how rigorously they have been subjected to the scientific theory and passed. The Book of Mormon mentions pigs and horses. It mentions battles with 100,000 deaths involving iron swords. It mentions chariots, i.e. wheeled vehicles. Yes, chariots. You know, we have historical data that tells us that when Cortez came down into the Valley of Mexico, he was met by Moctezuma, the revered speaker of the Mexica people, and that Moctezuma was born on a litter by litter bearers, carried literally on the backs of the serving class. The same was true of the first meeting between the Inca and Francisco Pizarro. There was not a horse to be seen, or a sheep, or a goat, or a pig, by any, not one, nowhere in the historical data does anybody record seeing any of that before Europeans brought them to these continents. Dr. John continues, it mentions olive trees. It mentions, it being of Mormon, mentions silk. Now, for instance, we know as a matter of historical fact that a group of disaffected Frenchmen left La Belle France and emigrated to West Central Alabama, what would become Alabama, Stan, and founded a place called Demopolis. Democracy City, the People's City. And they brought with them the artifacts and evidences of agriculture from their former land, and that included olive trees and grapevines, which they stuck in the soil and which died because they were not suited to being grown in West Central Alabama. Lots of stuff grows well there. Grapes and wine grapes, you know, and olive trees ain't among them. Silk. Silk. If you read 1493, you know that the initial interplay, the very uneasy interplay of trade between China and Spain was initiated in the Philippines over silk. You know that before then, the Silk Road had existed. A very dangerous caravan route from Asia into the Middle East and then Europe proper. That there had been navigation to places like India where silk was obtained. Don't you think that if Columbus had run across a little bit of silk in the Americas, he would have gone back with literally a boatload of it and said to Queen Isabella, "Sister, you're going to be dressing real good now." It's part of the thing, it's part of the reason that Columbus got in such hot water. The only thing he could point to was finding a bunch of land that was inhabited by a bunch of poorly clothed people who seemed perfectly happy before they got there and then started dying like flies, either from disease or murder. It took a while for the gold to get found, and that's when the Spanish crown started getting real happy. But they were decidedly not happy with Cristobal Colón. I still get pissed off every time I see the statue of that freak out in front of Union Station in Washington, D.C. I'm thinking, because it's especially odious because you've got noble Columbus standing there and you've got a kneeling Indian off to one flank, and it is disgusting. As noted in a previous program, at some point I finally got to tour the inside of the old part of the United States Capitol where all those paintings are, like of the signing of the Declaration of Independence and stuff. And there are two paintings there that I would just like to see removed. I mean, go put them in the Smithsonian or something, but let's get it out of our national self-myth. One being the baptism of Pocahontas. Oh, there's the day she became a human being. Of course, she died shortly thereafter of the smallpox and everything. And the other is the arrival of DeSoto at the Mississippi River, which probably never happened, but also involves a picture of a stunned and amazed and cowering native going, "What the is going on here?" And there stands DeSoto on his charger. Or there sits DeSoto on his charger, I guess.
Well, these things happen.
And it's all just obnoxious. All of these things, the silk, the olive trees, the chariots, the iron swords, the 100,000 deaths in battle, all of these things, Dr. John notes, there is zero legitimate archaeological evidence. Zero, in capital letters, as in none, nil. Nihil. Niente. Nicht. Non. The Mormons, however, are bent on finding evidence for it all. Dr. John continues, so what's funny about this Mormon approach is it's entirely compartmentalized. It's a huge academic echo chamber. Remember him talking about peer-reviewed journals and everything? Every claim I've read with a citation is sourced to papers put out by an outfit called the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, based at, drumroll, ready for it, Brigham Young University, and run by the LDS Church, or contained in a non-peer-reviewed book by a man named John L. Sorensen. Sorensen, in turn, is a former chair of the BYU Anthropology Department. His book, An Ancient American Setting for the Book of Mormon, was published in 1996 by, yes, you guessed it, you win, the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies. This book presents so-called evidence that practically everything in the Columbian Exchange was occurring in the New World all along. Horses, pigs, goats. Right. Wheat, barley, rye. Right. What I have access of it, Dr. John says, reads like a hot mess of unsighted claims. Indians grew barley, and weak analogy. This stela appears to show a chariot. When I first read Dr. John's email, I was reminded, yes, and there are other people that say that Mayan stelae depict ancient astronauts. Only, why can't they just be understood to depict some really brilliant people who were not quite brilliant enough to keep from eating themselves, well, actually, burning themselves out of house and home? There was no massive battle of 100,000 people. The Mayan city-states, much like the ancient Greek city-states, did war amongst themselves, and yeah, they did some human sacrifice and so forth, but they also developed an incredibly complex written language which really existed, unlike Reformed Egyptian, and which has been, over painstaking decades, decoded and translated, and can be read now by people who wish to study it hard enough. We know the rulers' names. We know the date of their ascent, the date of their death. Some of their graves have been found. Right? But they collapsed their own civilization because they were obsessed with building pyramids, and they're lovely pyramids, of course. But they were building pyramids in the tropics, and they liked for their pyramids to be really shiny and white, so they, what did they do? Yes, of course, they dug up limestone, and they cut down all their forests to make the fires to burn the limestone to get the lime to gesso the pyramids. And when all the trees were gone, well, guess what happened after that? Yeah, I know. You know, too. As for the claim, Dr. John continues, as for the claim that archaeologists are covering up evidence to keep the Mormons down, really, God, just another case of the heathens keeping the Mormons down. That's, in a word, absurd. It's as absurd as the claim that biologists keep down evidence against evolution. Yeah, we hear that, too. In both cases, legitimate evidence would absolutely ensure the archaeologist or biologist lifelong fame and fortune. Any biologist who came up with a credible alternative to natural selection as a driving force of evolution would win a Nobel Prize. Any archaeologist who could demonstrate metallurgy among pre-contact North American Indians could choose his university and name his pay. Or hers. They have quite a game right here. Fine for them. But when they try to sneak in wild claims from bad history and archaeology, I get a bit steamed. Dr. John says, I have enough trouble getting my students to check the sources and assumptions behind truth claims about the past that I don't need a bunch of well-funded pseudoscientists muddying the waters. Dr. John closed, saying, end rant, and if you've hung on this long, I'm impressed. Well, I know you've hung on this long because this is fascinating. Utterly fascinating. And Ray, contemplating the real questions burning all of our minds. Did anyone ask what the F is wrong with the Osmonds? Yeah. Marty's tuned in. Obviously, the proof of the Book of Mormon Wars has been waiting for Indiana Jones to find it. Movie number 5 or 6. Yeah. So I just wanted to share all of this with you because nobody in the for-profit media have the guts to talk about this weirdness. But I want to be understood that I'm not trying to single out Mormonism for being weirder than most or differently. They're all full of baloney. They all ask you to believe impossible things that could not possibly happen. That's why they're impossible. I guess I'm being a little redundant. But there aren't any temple priests of Shiva running for president this year. How do you know? What do we really know about Barack Obama? Only one party has a candidate running who is a prince of his church, who holds to doctrines that the vast majority of this country are unclean for purposes of entering the sanctuary where they perform their rituals, whatever they may be. I just have this vision of a bunch of people standing around in white long johns. You put your left foot in, you put your left foot out, you put your right foot in, and you shake it all about. Religion. Religion, religion, religion. Oh! It's painful. It's just painful. So that's where we find ourselves at the end of this evening's filibobster. Now you probably know more than you ever wanted to know about Mormons. But I think what's important for you to understand, and for me to understand, is that we are unclean. We're not special. They're special. Maybe that's why Anne thinks it would be so awesome. Maybe that's why we needed reminding how lucky we unclean are that a clean man like the Willard of Oz is willing to be our president for us. Hallelujah. Did I hear this right? Did the Willard of Oz's wife show up on Jay Leno last night wearing leather? What is she, a Mormonatrix? A member of the Latter Dom Saints? Sheesh. So, jump in. Your conversation, your contributions to the conversation are more than welcome. You know the number, right? 877-443-2366 or on your nickel, 304-658-3333. This is listener-supported, liberal, progressive conversation radio. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is The Horn on Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Sing it, John.
Can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time, sooner or later. later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell them that God's gonna cut them down. Tell them that God's gonna cut them down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me with a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He called my name and my heart stood still when he said, John, go do my will. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. You can run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to light. You can run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Yes, indeed, 9 minutes past the hour. This is Unclean Radio.
Unclean!
I'm Bob Kincaid. That's a stick of cake. Not that I want to be one of them. Not that I'd go across the street and see the inside of their special clubhouse for their imaginary friend. But it simply militates against the idea, the egalitarian ideas that underpin what we hope America is. Then again, I guess religions evolve too, to one degree or another. Although not a single one of them has evolved to the point where all of their adherents want to stop killing somebody else for some perceived slight to the faith. I read it over at Alternet, but it came from his own website. Juan Cole had some brilliant observations along these lines, and his piece is well worth reading. And he notes along the way that while so many people are hung up on this assumption of Muslim barbarity. There's more than enough barbarity to go around all over the religious universe. So let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
Yes.
Oh, well, you don't hate this. This is Granny T in Tennessee.
Well, Granny T, I don't hate this at all. I love hearing from you.
Well, you're talking to Southern Baptist, you know.
Well, I'm a recovering Southern Baptist, too.
Good Southern Baptist who has somewhat recovered and is now one of the most hated Democratic socialists.
It's terrible when it happens to us, isn't it? I mean, no, but I grew up in a part of Alabama where the Southern Baptists were the weirdo liberals.
No shit. What part of Alabama was that?
Northwest corner of the state.
Oh, northwest. Oh.
Yeah, the Shoals area. Your real hardcores were your church.
I had folks down that lived just southeast of Birmingham, and I have drilled dolphins out of Corinth down the 72 on the 157 or something.
Oh yeah, I know one.
Muscle Shoals and all that many times.
Yeah, I grew up in Florence, and Muscle Shoals was just across the river.
Well, boy, you got some good music down there, I tell you that.
Oh, isn't it? That's a mighty special little corner of the world.
Well, it is, but anyway, I am, as you say, digressing somewhat. But man, you peaked hell out of my interest on so many subjects. You have read every book in the world, and that was always one of my objectives, but.
Oh, there's a few I've yet to get to, Granny D.
But when I was a kid, I was too busy chopping cotton and picking cotton, when I started out now, you know, I'm 66 years old. When I started out, we had a team. My daddy had a team. It was a damn big old mule and a big old part draft horse. I mean, it's a big old team, good work team. So I always say we had a dressage mule, you know?
Yep.
Can't let Queen Annie, you know, get ahead of us on that store. But, you know, you never had no dressage mule.
Yeah, you know, I missed my dressage lesson today, and I always feel bad when I do, because my dressage lesson with my $70,000 tax write off horse, it just brightens my day.
Well, we just had a straw hat for iron.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, I'm digressing too much because I know you have so many intelligent callers, and I want to.
You're doing just fine. You digress all you want.
I really wanted to tell you that those Mormons. I was still married up to my second husband at that time, and had some folks up in Montana also. And we drove from Texas. Was living in Texas at that time, and. You know, made a couple of road trips up there. This was our younger days, you know. And went sightseeing through Salt Lake City. And, you know, I wanted to visit that big old pretty temple or tabernacle or mausoleum or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
And
any one of the above will suit nicely.
Yeah.
Pile of bricks.
Yeah, I'm not a little scaredy cat old lady. I work for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, and my husband, he wasn't no small sized dude, and with a few other folks, and you talk about this, the entree into that place, you'd have to have your damn collision course with you to get in there.
I think.
I am telling you. I mean, I ain't as scaredy, you know, when we was kids, you know, scaredy cat that
sure.
you would hear that.
Yeah.
And I can't talk better than this. When I was in the corporate world in Houston, I could enunciate and whatnot.
But isn't it a lot more comfortable just to?
It is, and my beloved second husband and I split in 1990, and then God, as your buddy Malloy would say, God sent me about 3 lightning bolts of health issues. So I had to retire. I always thought I'd be able to go back to work, but I had to retire back up here to Tennessee, you know, where we're a bunch of little old dirt farmers, no big plantations and nothing like that, you know.
Yeah.
And still got quite a bit of land up here.
Well, it's pretty country that way.
Well, it is, but, you know, you can't own land if you don't pay those darn taxes on it.
Yeah, sure. There's always a mechanism of taking it away.
Yeah, well, we got eminent domain, I think, over the years. And they go back farming to the 1800s somewhere. It's a little old town I'm close to. I don't like to say it on the radio because... You know, some trolls listening in.
You never know when some weirdo's going to tune in.
Well, I live out in the boonies, but, you know, I get my mailbox baseball batted again. Or,
well, I know what you're talking about. It has nothing.
One of them hang-up calls, your machine answers, and there's a gunshot and then a hang-up.
Oh, nice.
Not kidding.
I don't doubt you. We've got a rash of burglaries going on around here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, about 10 different places been broken into. Somebody's working it hard, and we're just trying to be diligent and alert and not leaving the house unattended for too awful long.
Get your firearms locked down, boy. We're just that... This little old town, I'll tell you where it is. It's Jackson. It's about, I guess, the biggest stop off between Memphis and Nashville.
I know Jackson.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay.
I part of the reason that I so love archaeology is I once actually considered pursuing it as a calling.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to participate on a dig not too awful far from there.
Is that Pinson?
Yeah, it's a magnificent archaeological park.
Oh, yeah,
and the state of Tennessee preserved it. I mean, a lot of the mounds got cut down by farmers over the 150 years or so.
Yeah, but it is a distinguished park now, so you better not be digging out there no more.
Well, right. This was a legitimate dig, and we found some fascinating stuff. And along the way, I got to know Jackson and West Tennessee pretty good.
Yeah. Well, what time period was that in?
Oh, that would have been, good gracious, I was just a little baby liberal then. That'd be about 1983.
Oh, well, you still a baby. You still a baby. I was in Texas at that time. But, my son, he's in his mid-30s, well, over mid now.
We'd get off the
college. He worked summers out there.
We'd get off the dig at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon because it'd get way too hot to dig anymore and go get cleaned up. And you know, we'd started. You know, the sun comes up pretty early in the summer, and we'd start out at 5:36 in the morning, dig till about 2, and get all cleaned up. And carloads of us would go into Jackson, especially on Fridays.
Yeah.
Have a right good time.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm glad you didn't go south. You ever hear all the stories about the McNary County?
Oh, I know. Yes. Oh, yeah. I once.
Ryan Mobb, the Buford Pusser movies.
Well, I met when I was a little boy. He was signing books over at a car dealership. I met Buford Pusser.
Nothing.
Yep.
Yeah. What? Yeah, that family,
Down Selmer was the book, Walking Tall was taken from a book called The 12th of August.
Yeah, and W.R. Morris wrote one about the state, his name of it, State Line Mob, but, and I read that, but anyway, so, okay, well, let me get to your subjects now, so.
Okay.
I just thought I'd make that little announcement because most people never heard of it, you know.
Yeah.
And I am, when my finances permit, I am going to get your hillbilly. I forget what you said it was, your hillbilly shirt.
Oh, I think you'll. I think folks around there will love it. The Save the Endangered Hillbilly T-shirt from Coal River Mountain Watch.
Yeah. I appreciate that, too, because I don't know if you know that Jefferson County, which contains Birmingham, Matt Tybee wrote a whole big old one of his hot dog articles on that, how they screwed Jefferson County and Birmingham out of God knows how much money. And it all started with the environmental lawsuit, which my relatives were real involved with about the Cahaba River. You know, dumping raw sewage and all that crap in the Cahaba River. And that river, it was the longest running and still is. They've cleaned it up tremendously. And that was back in the early 90s as they filed the suit. And it all stemmed from that and got into from 33. I think their suit was $36 million, and it all spawned from that. And when they crashed and burned, I mean, it was billions of bucks involved. And some of the politicians went to jail, but none of those damn Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan.
No, none of the parasites.
Mm-mm. No, I'm one of my sisters now. I'm only the, you know, I'm number three of 11 kids, so, you know, we go around way back and all around the world, folks down there, my stockbroker sisters in Alabama, my nephew, and I got a, you know, as I say, I apologize for my language, and maybe I do overdo the...
Nah, you're doing just fine. No apologies necessary.
Do the redneck thing, and as for hillbillies, we had some Washington folk, Washington State folk come down here and visit, and they'd take pictures of us and hear our, you know, movies and all that and send them back, and these are our hillbilly relatives, and so... We got all pretend mad and said, "Damn it, we're not hillbillies, we're rednecks."
Exactly.
So anyway, but let me get back to the stuff here. When and how did class warfare become such a taboo term in this country?
I think Granny T, it became taboo as soon as the people waging the war realized that we had figured out who was waging it and who was winning.
Yeah.
Because the class warfare has been going on for a long, long time. The difference
but
being
nobody will just come out and address it. And I've read a lot of Eric Foner, F-O-N-E-R. He's a big deal labor historian. I don't know if you've read it.
I'm familiar with him. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just wondered, since as you know everything, have read all the books, everything about everything, I figured you might know the.
Well, it's like everything else the right wing does, Granny T. Whatever they are doing, they will accuse us of. It's diversion, it's transference, and probably several other fancy psychological terms. But they know they're waging a war on us. The Koch brothers know that they're trying to shake our pockets out. They know.
I know. And New Yorker had Jill Lepore. She's a professor of early American history. Got an article in the 924 New Yorker. Name of it is "The Lie Factory: How Politics Became a Business," and it goes all through it, you know, and I had read Edward Bernays, and I think he's Freud's double nephew or something like that, who wrote the book named Propaganda, and they say that that's where Hitler got all his Mein Kampf stuff. I don't know if that's factual or not.
I'm not sure either, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, but I'm sure you're familiar with Edward Bernays.
I am, and yeah. I'm sure others in this audience are even more so.
Yeah, and but I had never known about who started it. It started out as Campaigns Incorporated. Let's see, in 1933, it was the first political consulting, an industry unknown before Campaigns Incorporated, and it was started in 1933 by Clem Whitaker and Leon Baxter. And that, if you get a chance, I don't know if you subscribe or not. It might be online. It might not have a lock on it. I get PO'd because I can't afford like I used to, you know, buy thousands of dollars worth of books, you know.
Right.
And everything, the Financial Times, you know, gotta pay to subscribe now. And the New York Times, you can get 10 articles.
10 articles a month, yeah. They meter it hard, too.
And you know, real journalism is just gone to hell. It used to be the 5 W's and the 1 H, which I learned in school. Now, you know, I can bitch about the schools a lot, too, because evidently, and through my grandchildren, who are, you know, they are over 18 now, except one, got a brand new one, 2 years old. My daughter, they wanted a little girl. I said, you know, she's the oldest. She's about to that 40 age, so they gave it one more shot. Never had an egg of a boy. But anyway, back to the point again. Wherever. I keep digressing.
That's all. You know what? This has been nearly 7 years of digressing, so you are by far not the first, nor will you be the last, Granny T.
Well, I wish I had known, but until I guess I could still get out and about until about 2006 or 2007 a little bit, but now I'm pretty much one of them people we used to pray for, you know, the sick and the afflicted and the shut-ins. So
I remember the phrase. And let's remember, brethren and sistren, as we pray, and as every head bowed and every eye closed, the sick and the afflicted and the shut-ins who are listening today via their radios, God be with them. Yep.
Yeah, but as today, I'm with the Joseph Campbell School of the Power of Myth. No, it's all a big mystery. So I'm with that school anymore. But I'm just wondering about the labor history and how, you know, class war, which
was. Well, look, you know, there used to be a labor page in newspapers. That went the way of the dodo. Labor history is not taught in schools. Instead, it's the history of the parasites and the people who.
You know how we used to accuse other countries of cleansing their textbooks. This country has cleansed our textbooks as bad or worse or.
Oh, when the state of Texas declares that a chapter or a mention in a history book of Phyllis Schlafly is more important than a mention of Cesar Chavez. You know, holy cow. I mean, that is educational dogmatic shark jumping as far as I'm concerned.
And it's been that way for years. I mean, Texas was the big approver. And some dude in, I think some preacher in Mississippi, Woodham or something, but yeah.
Oh, Wildmon?
Huh?
Yeah, the Reverend Daniel, Donald Wildbond.
Yeah, some real, yeah. But that's been going on for years, but boy, it has never been. It was not that way back when I went to school in the ancient times, and we did. I mean, the five W's and was, they call it, some of them just call it the six W's. It's who, what, when, where, why, and how.
Yep.
I'm sure you, I don't know, you know, I'm sure you ran across that somewhere.
It was an essential in writing classes,
yep.
And it was drilled into our minds once we started writing persuasively in high school,
yep.
and it was darn near holy writ in the journalism department.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
I went to one of those high schools that had a journalism department.
Well, that's where I learned it. We didn't necessarily have a journalism class. But we had some first grade English teachers, you know, just some first grade ones.
Yep.
Now we also had some unreconstructed presidents too, but,
Yeah, you mean the ones that teach about the War of Northern Aggression?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one. That's the one.
The recent unpleasantness.
Oh, and your Senator Bob Byrd, now, God, I love to hear him speak, and I loved his spiel against the Iraq War. Now, I know he got reconstructed somewhat from his olden beliefs. What did you think about him?
There was a great deal of statesmanship to admire in Senator Byrd, especially long about the time of the Iraq War.
Yeah.
I had a lot of issues with him over, naturally, what's being done to this state by the coal industry.
Yeah.
But even toward the end of his days, when he realized that his days were numbered, he put out one of the most stunning pieces of writing about the coal industry that has ever been put forward in the U.S.
Yeah.
Of all the problems I had with him, probably the greatest one, Granny T, had to do with the nomination of Sammy Alito to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
Because he was one of the ones that led the capitulation of the Democrats to letting that thug onto the court.
Yeah, okay. I was not aware of that, but I am aware that Joe Biden... Our Inspector Mangley and Joe Biden on the D side, they lampooned, on Thomas. I mean, they put the brakes on taking him to hell because, Jan Mayer and Jill Abramson, at the time, Mayer was writing for the New York Times and Abramson was writing for, I think, Wall Street Journal, and they wrote a book, Strange Justice. I don't know if you ever read that one or
not. That's one I missed.
But they had several women who were backing up Anita Hill to the hilt, and Biden stopped them from the testimony.
Yep.
And that was an unpleasant situation in my mind.
Oh, that whole affair was nothing but shameful, Granny T.
Yeah, but moving along the list here. Senator Byrd was just, he was akin to Strom Thurmond, but he changed horses maybe at the end of his stream or something, it seemed like to me. Because I remember his sermon on you know, getting into that damn Iraq mess.
And, you know, Senator Byrd's speech on the Iraq War features prominently in that film that I got to watch up in Madison a couple of weeks ago, Phil Donahue's documentary, Body of War.
Yeah.
It is excerpts from that speech are the counterpoint to the theme that runs through it of, you know, how the elected leadership of the how the elected Congress capitulated to a bunch of lies that were just entirely manufactured by the Bush administration.
Yeah, and that's when I, you know, of course I didn't know all his history and whatnot, but that is when he did catch my attention, and I thought, you know, I thought, well, damn, you know. Oh, and one of our happy local senators, Senator Bob Corker, he was one of that happy bunch that met on Obama's inauguration, and they had that pretty meeting at that pretty restaurant where he must be a one-term president.
Yes.
Not that I'm... I mean, I was an Obama fan, but, hell, I got over that. He's another core participant.
He is. There's no doubt about that, Granny T, but the problem...
No, I don't vote for him.
But
no
the
doubt
yeah, the, pro- the problem is that the alternative is absolutely unbearable.
Oh, no, it's evil. I mean, total damn evil. Man.
You know, from the standpoint of what we put up with here in West Virginia... If the bishop was to get elected president, this whole state would blow up like a lit cigarette thrown into a truckload of Roman candles.
Well, I mean, I told you my folks are farmers in Monsanto. I mean, hell, we get it every which way too, and that. They got that stuff going over on in the East Tennessee, you know, in the mountains.
Yeah, up in they do mountaintop removal up in the northeast corner of Tennessee.
Yeah,
they absolutely do.
Yeah, and have friends that. Well, my last traveling was to see friends in. Well, actually, it was Black Mountain. Then they since moved to Asheville, and which now that's a pretty good little town.
I've never been there, but I'm told it is a magnificent place.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. But anyway, you know, there's just so many of your comments, like on the Mormon voodoo and the Hitler propaganda and all. And another thing is you took up for Jimmy Carter too.
Well, I've long thought, Granny T, that he was getting a much rougher ride than anything he ever deserved, and now the data are coming out to prove that those of us who have said that he was getting a raw deal, well, the data are on our side.
That is absolutely correct, and that damn Ronald Reagan, in 1980, assumed his first speech after his nomination had been confirmed. Was made his first speech in damn Philadelphia, Mississippi, Neshoba County.
Yes, indeed.
And you know what happened there?
Murder. Cold-blooded murder.
Yeah. So I do believe, I have a strong personal belief, that's where we got a lot of our Reagan Democrats. That is my personal opinion.
Yeah, well, during that same campaign, he also went to Tuscumbia, Alabama, or maybe he opened his re-election campaign in Tuscumbia, Alabama. I don't remember the particulars,
well,
Granny
I don't,
T.
I don't remember.
But Tuscumbia, Alabama was the home of the Klan at the time.
Well, you know, the Klan originated here in Pulaski, Tennessee, I think it was.
Yep, just up the road from the Shoals.
Yep.
Straight up U.S. 43.
Yeah. So all your comments on those subjects, the Mormon voodoo and, well, all the voodoo, you know, big guy in the sky voodoo, that just, and all your reading just picks hell out of my curiosity, you know, I'm just sort of as we say, sort of disgusted with the picture of our country at this point. Now,
there's disgust, and then there's outright fear.
Well, I do.
I'm afraid. I mean, I don't run around being afraid of stuff, Granny T, but I'm afraid for my country.
Yeah, I am too, Bob. I truly am afraid. It's been happening, and I thought, well, you know, Occupy Wall Street, I was thinking, well, thank God, finally, maybe this will get rolling, you know, sort of like we did in back in the 60s. And now my daddy, you would think, oh, you know, one of them southern little small farmer boys, you know how they are. Well, no, our family never was like that, because we was getting out there working with and as hard as them black people. And and just a P.S. on that, the N-word is just as popular around here as it ever was when you are in certain company.
Oh, I don't doubt it. I know that for a fact.
But you know, in my raising, I can remember, you know, the separate water fountains and all that sort of stuff. So I guess that is why, you know, after I shipped out to college and whatnot, my first husband and I, we worked his way through, and he became a chemical engineer, and so that sort of, his father was a teamster, and my folks were farmers, so we are not from the aristocratic classes, you know.
Exactly.
But today, to this day, and he's a well-educated fella, and took French and all that, but he is still racist to the core.
Not surprising. It may yet be 1,000 years before that, 500 years before that. Before that's ever cleared from.
I don't know, I did get reconstructed, and just never in our family, it just never was that way. I mean, you know, it just never was.
Yeah.
Now, we didn't talk it up or anything like that. We just worked our ass off and, you know, minded our own business. And my folks didn't smoke or drink or make us go to church, either one. And, you know, my mother didn't cuss. You could about 3 times maybe in my memory I can remember a curse word ever coming out of her mouth, and she'd be 90 years old.
Oh, bless her.
Yeah, well, her granny lived till she was 97, and she told our mother, and our mother remembers it, you know, when them damn Yankees come through their farm and took all their meat out of the smokehouse and got all their livestock and all that sort of stuff. But, I mean, we was just small time, you know. We've done genealogy back on the stuff, and now my paternal side, my kind of a grandmother. Now she's the one that took us kiddos to church when we were youthful, but we all pretty much stopped when we got into our early teens and we began the thinking process. But in our family, out of 11 kids raised on a small farm, you don't expect too much education. But there's some damn geniuses. One sister was a valedictorian. About half of us were honor graduates and stockbroker now. My nephew, a master's in computer engineering and program from Georgia Tech. And he's been in Palo Alto for years now. And he recently changed jobs. He was a supervisor of 9,000 and something software engineers. So, I mean, I didn't get none of it, but there is some true genius in there. And I've just always, as I say, you have accomplished one of my goals, reading every book in the world. And then, you know, even when, like you were talking about all the Mormon scholars and whatnot, and even when you read, you have to do the, I'll just call them the six W's on whoever wrote the, you know, the
track. Well, it boggles my mind because, you know, yeah. I kid around, but I mean, I was on that site, and yeah. No, there were no chariots, there were no iron blades, there were no silken gowns. The headdress that the female that was in one of the mounds was wearing, I remember very well, was made out of bark fibers, and she had shells that came from the Great Lakes.
Yeah,
and she had rattles attached to the outside of either knee, and the rattles were inscribed with geometric designs, and they were made from the back of the human skull, two backs of the human skull put together, and sort of thonged together with some little pebbles in them to make them rattle. But you know, now that there were no golden tablets written in Reformed Egyptian or. No, that, it just wasn't there because, you know, it's a bunch of baloney.
That's what I love about that religion. So it is of such recent vintage that the old Joseph Smith, hell, he was a bank swindler and everything else.
Well, everything that's in the Book of Mormon, everything.
Got onto that scale.
Yeah, everything that's in the Book of Mormon, Granny T, is derived from the popular fiction of the day.
Yeah.
I mean, the minute that settlers moving west began seeing what we now call Indian mounds,
yeah.
they started coming up with this idea of the lost tribes of Israel. That
yeah,
was nothing new. Joseph yeah. Smith just glommed onto it for his con.
Well, that's what I say. He even before he invented that religion, he was a bank swindler and, you know, a flim-flam man and got ran out of a lot of places.
And he was charged and convicted mm-hmm. of running one of these bunco scams.
Yeah.
Well, Granny T, it is wonderful to hear from you this evening, and don't be a stranger, and I hope you call in just
well,
as quick as the
I'm
spirit
sorry
moves you.
I'm sorry to take up...
Don't you apologize. You haven't taken up anything.
One more little item on your recent trip up to Wisconsin. You mentioned some of my favorite folks, old Jim Hightower. Now, in my Texas period, he was the agricultural, state agricultural commissioner or whatever you call it at that time, and I have loved him ever since. And Molly Ivins. Now you talking about loving somebody.
Oh mercy! Wouldn't you love to have her around?
I miss that girl. And Kathleen Turner is doing a one-woman show.
I'd love to see that. I really, really would.
Yeah, and Bill McKibben. I love him. He writes a lot of stuff. For
he is he's a brilliant man. And you know that recent article that he wrote over at Rolling Stone. Got more downloads than any other article that has ever appeared in that magazine.
I do not doubt that one bit. So, if you get a chance, I had always admired hell out of Thomas Jefferson. But in the Smithsonian magazine this month, I think the name of the thing is The Dark Side of Thomas Jefferson or something. But
oh, there's plenty of that.
Huh?
There's plenty of that dark side.
But this is some new stuff. And, okay, I promise this is the last one here. You hit Kurt Vonnegut Jr. all the time. One of my favorite books in the world is Slaughterhouse-Five or The Children's War.
Children's Crusade, exactly.
Old Candide, Voltaire, and The Panglossian View, it's all for the best, and Martin's View of Ken, My Garden. Okay, I'm going to let you go, Brother Bob, and my birthday in October, I'll try to send you a small birthday present.
Well, bless your heart. Thank you very kindly. That's mighty kind and it's much appreciated.
I'm going to let you go, and you talk to some of them well-educated folks now.
You quit sandbagging.
Well, folks, when you talk like this, and especially when your second husband is from Philly, and you go up north, and the minute you start speaking a bit southern, they assume immediately that you are just totally illiterate and cannot read.
They do one of two things. They do either that, or they look at you in wide-eyed wonder, and they say, "Say that again." And you say, "What?" And they say, "Anything you want to. I like to hear you talk."
Yeah, got a lot of that too in both Philly and Montana too.
Well, Granny T, you have a lovely evening.
Okay, and I'm really gone now, Brother Bob, and I must be a southern gentle lady and apologize for your time. Taking so much of your time. As our good buddy Mark would say, keep it lit, and as we say, keep it between the ditches.
Amen. Amen. Shiny side up and the dirty side down.
You got it.
You take care, Granny T. Bye now. Granny T calling from the great state of Tennessee. Onward we roll. Hey, welcome to the program.
My God, what an old history.
Isn't she wonderful?
Just remarkable. I mean, in spite of that accent and, you know, southern drawl, there's a great deal of substance there.
Oh, there is. There's still waters run deep, Jim, and you know it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They certainly do. And it was an enjoyable conversation. I mean, I was just amazed that, you know, as she went from one subject to the other, the things that she mentioned, she was just absolutely delightful.
Well, that the southern art of conversation, maybe that's why conversation radio evolved here. Because you got to be able to hold up your own end in a good talk.
Well, that's true. Absolutely, you do. And what she was talking about, I'm just sitting here gunning sticks. But some of the things she was talking about, and some of the things you were talking about, you were mentioning having been on an archaeological dig.
Oh, yes.
This must have been like a burial mound as opposed to a ceremonial mound.
Jim, that whole place is fascinating. It was, as far as anybody can tell, a massive necropolis. I think they cataloged it as somewhere, and we're talking about everything from 4 inches off the ground to 72 feet high, something like at one point in time, that whole area was a city comprised of something like 1,000 mounds.
Absolutely, it was mound country. And we talked,
some of them are ceremonial. They're flat-topped where you would imagine some sort of structure was up on top. And others of them are conical, and those tend to have burials in them.
Exactly. So ones that which I dug with my father and his friend, who's an archaeologist, were ceremonial mounds. And it was just really interesting because I was just a boy then. And, of course, we were interested in swinging on vines and things like that because this is right near the Watery River on Mulberry Plantation. And they dug with, like, teaspoons and a toothbrush.
Toothbrushes, dental instruments, and the ever ready Marshalltown trowel.
Right, absolutely. And you could absolutely take a look and see where the shaman's hut had burned down because you could see the carbonized bamboo or wood or whatever.
Yeah, the post hole stains. Right.
Yeah, and I still have a big board of arrowheads that my father mounted in. And that brought back a lot of good memories. It really did. Now, you were going into earlier this evening about the Mormon doctrines and stuff like that. And it's just amazing what these people believe. And they have every right to believe it as long as they don't push it off on me. And you
right.
Know,
but the important thing, and I think that's what Dr. John was getting at, Jim, is don't be trying to palm it off on an unsuspecting public as reality or as science, which they do.
Well, it's basically bullshit and hagiography.
It's precisely. It's not. It is that all the way down to its toenails.
Well, that's the way I feel. I mean, for example, I have some strange beliefs of my own, but I don't go around publishing them or trying to convince other people. For example,
or that you read it on golden tablets that were written in Reformed Egyptian.
No. But I mean, what I was talking about was the, for example, the perhaps the visitation of intelligent beings to parts of South America and to parts of Egypt and places like that, and how they may have had some type of assistance and some sort of galvanization from a higher intelligence.
It's possible, but my personal humanistic view is to have a certain degree of respect for those cultures and realize that there are some things that are so universal that sooner or later you figure them out. I mean, the Mayan calendar that's causing such a stir this year because one of the long counts ends around December the 21st, 2012. It's just a matter of mathematical extrapolation. It's like a logarithm or something.
Well, and
it's all based on generation after generation after generation of noting the arrival of the planet Venus in the morning and evening skies.
Yeah, well, the Mayan calendar basically has survived in one area, and that's the Dresden Codex, and the rest of the codices were destroyed by the Spanish. And I don't know who broke the code on that calendar or the Mayan language. I think it was a German archaeologist.
The language was broken by a number of people, one of them being, her first name was Linda. I think her last name was S-C-H-E-L-E, and she was a professor at the University of Texas. A Russian linguist and anthropologist was critical in the process as well. But the calendar wasn't really decoded so much. I mean, it was some of this stuff was explained to people like Bernardo de Sahagún when the Spanish conquest was being accomplished. They explained how the calendar works, and it is a genius thing. And the calendar of the Aztecs had been derived from the calendar of the Maya and the Toltecs. I mean, it is a long history of transmission of knowledge between fading and succeeding cultures.
Well, Bob, I've always thought that there had to be some type of spark there. And I'm not trying to go Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull and all that kind of stuff. But there was something there, in my opinion.
And that exactly, and that spark, I think, is the essential spark, the beauty, the beautiful human essential spark of basic humanity, where you wake up, where a people wakes up and realizes they're part of a larger world. I mean, consider the one foodstuff that is eaten by more people on this planet than any other is corn, what the native peoples called maize.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is the world's most brilliant example of bioengineering, because you can, to this day, see where maize came from. It came from a grass, Jim, called teosinte, T-E-O-S-I-N-T-E, and it is not in any wise recognizable as being kin to corn. But over the course of about 10,000 years, some really ingenious people worked with that grass until it became maize. Now, the same thing applies to the common potato in Peru. You and I see, being Southerners, we like a red potato sometimes or whatever. But you go to the grocery store and it was mostly you could get russets or reds, some whites. And now in places like the fancy schmancy parts of Kroger's, you can get those little fingerling potatoes and the purple potatoes and things like that. Well, that's chicken feed. You go to Peru, and there are thousands of varieties of potatoes, and they are eaten specific ways and prepared the breeds for specific purposes. They're freeze dried. I'd love to try it sometime. because of the way the climate operates in some of those mountainous areas, it'll get quite warm in the day, and then it'll get quite cold at night. And people set out these little potatoes, and they are literally freeze-dried over time, and they make a soup out of them. And the soup is said to be just magnificent.
Absolutely delightful to the palate, nourishing to the body. Absolutely. It's what they lived on.
Yeah. And
didn't have those in Europe. The Spanish had to take those over to Europe, and of course they became quite a staple.
Well, I think I mentioned the other night, even up to the time of Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was one of the first people to serve tomatoes on his table, because even in that age, there were a lot of people in this country or in the colonies or what have you, who were quite convinced that the tomato was poison.
Yeah.
Because they recognized that it was a kinship plant to deadly nightshade. So too is the potato. They are kissing cousins of deadly nightshade.
Well, agronomy is just in itself a very fascinating science and study in the history of plants and things as we have grown to develop them. And
But there is a spark there that we actually can probably know more about those sparks of genius as we observed it in the peoples of the Americas than we know about the sparks of genius that occurred to Europeans and Asians, because we saw it, we destroyed it, in medias res, if you know what I mean.
I do. And one more thing, there's something that's always fascinated me about the Incas and the peoples living in that area, and those are the Inca roads that could only have been designed from some type of altitude. I mean, something had to have precipitated that, in my opinion. I mean, when you have seen aerial photographs of the Inca roads, you have to really think very hard about how these things were designed. I'm not trying to be Eric von Daniken or whatever like that.
I understand.
But it gives me great cause for concern. And, you know, I just believe that there was some contact, perhaps, with a more intelligent life form that could have created a spark and galvanized these people into being able to construct, for example, the walls in Cuzco, as opposed to the walls in the pyramids of Egypt. You can't even get a credit card between those things. And they were all built without cement and have lasted over the centuries.
And they are, and the thing that the reason I recognize it as a factor of humanism as opposed to outside intervention, Jim, is because those walls are earthquake resistant.
Yeah, they are.
And if you are a people who live in an earthquake prone area, sooner or later, once you get your civilization up and running, you start dealing with the essentials. And one of the first things you come up with is, how do we keep everything we build from being destroyed by earthquakes?
Well, and these people were able to create designs of stone structure that architects in the 20th century.
Well, look at the great Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan in Mexico.
Oh yeah,
it's very interesting because the mathematics that goes into how that thing is laid out basically describe a culture that has an understanding of the mathematical concept of pi, and yet we only give credit to the ancient Greeks for coming up with 3.14.
It's a transcendental figure about resolution.
Right. But we give the Greeks credit for coming up with that, when in fact that pyramid, which was built, you know, Jesus, at the very beginning of this millennium or somewhere in that era, maybe 500 A.D., something like that, manifests an understanding of that transcendental mathematical concept.
Exactly. It's just incredible.
And I prefer, because of who and how I am, I prefer to give credit to the real geniuses that did the skull sweat to come up with it.
Well, you know, genius always begins with some type of spark. I mean, for example, I believe there were definite connections between these people and the Egyptians, for example. I mean, when I emailed you the other day, and I haven't photographed it yet, but I had two artifacts that were taken from one of the cenotes, or cenotes.
Yeah.
in the Yucatan. And they look as though both of them came from a pharaoh's tomb. The headdress, everything. There was some type of connection between these people, I do believe. I mean, even, well, I think there's the signs of the zodiac and other connections. There was definitely a connection between, I think, the Egyptians and the Mayans and the Aztecs and things like that.
Well, you know, there's that fascinating that fascinating book that a long time ago our buddy Lee in Texas and I discussed, in which a retired Royal Navy submariner, I think, did some independent research into trying to determine whether or not the Chinese treasure fleets went further than most people. You know, most people acknowledge that the Chinese treasure fleets went to India and the east side of Africa, but his theory is that they went all over the Americas too.
Well, they had to, because those boats were huge. And then all of a sudden, all naval construction in China was stopped.
It wasn't just stopped, it was forbidden.
Why?
On pain of death.
I don't know. I've never quite understood that.
That's historically understandable. That was the collapse of one dynasty and the rise of another. And China periodically oscillates through these periods of expansion and then contraction. While the treasure fleets were gone, a dynasty was succeeded by another one, and fell into one of those periods of introspective contraction.
Well, this is true, and Chinese history is punctuated by those elements that you just mentioned. But I'm going to say one more thing here in reference to extraterrestrials. And I don't know if you've ever had any experience with that sort of thing. But one night I did.
Well, I've been told that when you do have one of those, it is life-changing.
It is, and it was, because a friend and I were driving back from Charlotte in a convertible about 3 o'clock in the morning, and it wasn't a helicopter. I've been in too many of those. And you can hear them coming. It made no sound. It simply poised right above us. And then it went off into the distance at light speed, just like something out of Star Trek.
And there are tons and tons of similar accounts out there. I don't know. I don't have any answers.
But I'll tell you this. If one were to appear outside where I live and were to make itself known to me, I would try to ascertain, if I were able to, if they were friendly or hostile. And if they were friendly, I would say, hey, if you're looking for me, I'm willing to go. But can you take two cats?
Yeah. Well, you'd hate for Rupert and the Shady Lady not to miss out on the fun.
That's absolutely the truth. Like I said, if I were to be able to leave all this craziness in this world, and it's what we've talked about many times before, I would certainly be glad to do so, because I would, you know, it would be quite an experience, and to have some type of contact with an alien life form that God only knows how many generations or thousands of generations, you know, they may have been around and be able to develop so many answers to so many questions that plague our world today. So I'd be one of their first passengers, just as long as they weren't walking around on tripods trying to give me some type of injection in which to drink my blood. That would not be good, or to make me on their dinner list as Rod Serling did in That Thing to Serve Mankind. And on that note, I'm going to leave you where I found you, because we've got other people that more to talk and have more intelligent things to say than I.
Well, Jim, I think you do admirable battle on the field of intellect, so don't sell yourself short.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's still, like I say, there are a lot of heavy keys in my pocket now, but I do my best. And you take care, and God bless.
You too. Bye now. Our buddy Jim calling in, and lines opening up if you want to get in on the conversation. It's about 11 minutes past 8 p.m. here on the East Coast. We'll take a little break and come back. This is America's listener-supported home of conversation radio. This is The Horn, and I'm Bob Kincaid.
Well, he can almost taste the money that he was sitting in a den of thieves, looking for the great awakening, trying to find a way to leave. But that's when he got religion and the light went on inside. Is there somebody
It's a good conversation left in the program tonight. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. So glad to have you along in any way in which you are listening, be it live, be it podcast, be it the rerun stream. You pick. That's one of the glories of new media. I love that song. That's an Elton John track off of, what was it, 1982, 83, the Too Low for Zero album. Big comeback album back then in the 80s. But I love that line in there about a choir of angels singing in the tiki bar. You know, you drink enough of those Singapore slings and there's no telling what you're going to hear. And that line, we all make the same mistakes, we're going to wind up with a man. Man, does Elton John qualify as a prophet now? I mean, that's the early 80s, and he's singing a song that is, you know, Ted Haggard. We all make because hypocrisy, we all make the same mistake, we're going to wind up with a man. I guess the only thing missing is that we're going to wind up snorting meth off a man's butt. But, you know, that's the beauty of prophecy. It lies in its malleability, I suppose. Email coming in from Kate, subject line, otherworldly stuff. Jim, I'm on the same wavelength with you. Contact and sightings are life-changing, at least it was for me. We know so little about what's happening out there. You and I couldn't be on the same ship because I'm allergic to cats, but I'd love to meet you when we get over there when we get there. Thanks, Kate. And onward we go, back to the telephone. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
How you doing, Bill?
I'm just sitting here thinking. You were talking about those mound people, and I thought about that house Bo Diddley had. You know, made out of rattlesnake hide, and
yeah,
brand new chimney up on top, made out of human skull. Huh?
Yeah.
God.
You know, in all seriousness, those things do fascinate me, though, because, for instance, yeah, consider the shaman or priestess or chief or whatever she was that was found down there, and she's wearing shell beads from the Great Lakes.
Great Lakes, yeah.
Down in, not 100 miles from the Mississippi River in Tennessee. Now, just take for a moment and imagine, let your imagination run wild for a minute and contemplate a society complex enough to build a trade network that vast that would get shell beads down to the southwest corner of what is now Tennessee. No horses, no oxen, no goats, because, you know, we're not buying into that phony baloney, the Joseph Smith garbage.
No.
I know, it takes all the fun out of it, doesn't it? But the bottom of that, the other thing, the bottom of that mound, when it was excavated, and there are real ethical concerns about whether or not we need to dig into these things anymore, and I tend to land on the let's don't side of it. But that wasn't prevailing at the time. But the bottom of these mounds, there was a burnt clay floor, and then all the business of the burial, and then there was a sort of dome, it's probably not the right word, but a cap of sandstone rocks. And we knew, and I was told that it had been learned that the sandstone rocks came from a bluff about, at least 20 miles away. So no draft animals, one person or two people carrying a rock.
Yeah.
For that purpose. How can you not just admire the daylights out of a culture that can accomplish that?
It's amazing. What there are things that keep going on in the world that I'll never have the answers for. No matter how, and nobody else does either. It just is.
Right, but there's something offensive in the notion that the only way that the native peoples of this continent could possibly have developed anything approaching a civilization is because once again it's old world centric. The only way they could have possibly developed a civilization is if civilization were brought to them by somebody from the old world.
Yeah.
You know, to wit, you know, Mormonism's assertion that they're all, secretly the lost children of Israel.
Those of us who grew up, and I talk to people about this, those of us who grew up watching old 1930s movies on television, like westerns, etc., and there was a lesson in there. The cattle rustlers were in cahoots with the town banker in those movies. A lot of the Hopalong Cassidy stuff, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They were right up there in cahoots with them. And the other thing was the early American medical profession riding around on the wagon with some guy with a headdress next to him and selling 150 proof medicine. Here, drink this, you'll feel better.
Damn right you will.
And
then you'll feel like grim death the next morning.
Yeah.
You'll need another bottle.
There's when you start talking about these elaborate funerals, I said maybe that's where some of these guys that I've worked with, when I had to, you know, take care of my relatives, maybe that's where they tried painting you a picture. Like the one guy was trying to try to sell me a coffin with a lifetime guarantee. And one of my buddies was with me. Cause
took me a minute.
Well, my buddy was a cynical guy that was with me. I took him there on purpose because his mother had to bury his brother, and the director just skinned her. And my buddy turned to him and says, "Hey, man, you got one with automatic transmission and backup lights?" And at that point, the funeral director shut up, and he sold me something that was within the price range. You know, my sister had passed away, and I wanted my mother. You know, any money that was there was going to my mother, not to this guy.
Yeah.
You know. But I talked to the same guy this morning, and he and I don't get along anymore. And this is what I have to ask your opinion. When I start talking history with this guy, he's got a master's in political science, but he's been a public relations man most of his life. And his thing is, well, that's irrelevant. Anything that happened 30 or 40 years ago, that's all irrelevant. And to me, I can't buy
horse feathers.
That. Yeah, I believe in the karmic principle, like in what goes around comes around.
Yeah, I don't know that you can necessarily apply that to history, but history standing all by itself, Bill.
Yeah.
Look, we are, and I think a lot of people probably know about this, but this is just a for instance. You know, very few people remember that at the time of the Iranian hostage crisis, when those students were chanting and carrying signs, you know, we were all shown on American TV the footage of them carrying signs bearing the likeness of Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yeah.
I don't recall being shown, because I wouldn't necessarily have recognized him, but I don't recall it happening. They were all, but we know they were also carrying signs bearing the likeness of another individual. And that individual was Mohammad Mossadegh.
Oh, yes, 1952.
And we are still reaping the poisonous fruit of one of the CIA's first nefarious undertakings, that is, the overthrow of the democratically elected government of the state of Iran.
Yep.
By the CIA, done at the connivance, with the agreement of Eisenhower, but done at the connivance of Winston Churchill.
Yeah. And because he wanted the oil.
Because one of the things that the Mossadegh regime had done was to nationalize the oil, and Great Britain said, "No, well, we can't have the wogs out there thinking they own their own oil now, can we?"
You know, most Americans don't realize that 1919, when the British took over that area of Mesopotamia, they fought from 1919 to 1931 against insurrections. And they had to take the British army there and get the hell out of it because the Depression was, you know, killing them, and they couldn't afford this anymore. It just, things go on. But again, my buddy with, he's a smart kid. He was he's another project guy, and there's a few of us who were still friendly to the day. But I remember him as a kid. He was always a manipulator, and he was head of PR for Greyhound for a while. And Greyhound had that, little incident where a bull semen came out of the bottom part of a bus and was spilled all over the highway. I wrote to my buddy and I said, "I'd like to see you standing there talking to the press and keeping a straight face while you did it." Because, you know, trying to explain that one. But there are some people who get this way that they, I mean, to me, history just seems to go around in circles. You'll see the situation will be the same. The clothing styles and the weaponry and the bullshit will be different, but the same, they're looking for the same thing. Money, power, in the modern sense, or something to gain at somebody else's expense. And that's what I see going on and on and on, and I'm getting ready to check out, you know, I mean, to be honest, I'm a certain age, you start thinking, well, you know, yeah, it's going to happen here. And down there, I'd like to see what's around the corner, you know. It's just, a buddy of mine sent me 10 book reviews of new Civil War stuff, Civil War books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. And one guy did hit me in the head with a 2x4 when he was writing about Hood. You know, Hood was shot up pretty bad.
Yeah.
Leg and an arm. And this guy brought out the fact that there's a lot of theorists now that General Hood was pretty well under the influence of whatever painkillers he could use.
Laudanum.
Yeah, oh yeah, laudanum. Oh yeah, the guy, what was the guy from Red Harvest? The boyfriend of the
Mayor
Lee, he used to drink laudanum. You could buy that over the counter.
Well, I mean, the Romantic era poets, you know, Wordsworth, Coleridge especially was said to have a kick-ass laudanum habit going for him, and it was routine, you know, which it's basically an alcohol. It's a suspension. If I recall correctly, it's a suspension of opium in syrup form in alcohol.
Yep.
So you get it coming and going, and whoa. It's
perfectly legal.
Man, can you imagine if that stuff was legal? What it would sound like to listen to the Limbaugh show?
Oh.
By the way, I want to share a couple of things with you. You mentioned reviews of Civil War books. The revisionism has started, Bill. This may drive you a little crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, just listen to the way this language is phrased. Now, I get right-wing pitches all day, every day. I get a lot more of them from the right wing than I do our side. But this comes from somebody who's out there hustling a book. The South has always possible story guest. Are general portrayals of the South exactly accurate? What the hell does that mean, exactly accurate? Something's either accurate or it's not. The South has always intrigued writers and Hollywood. We have romanticized versions of the Civil War South as seen in Gone with the Wind and John Jake's North and South series.
Yeah, don't get me started on Gone with the Wind.
I know. And then she continues, we have the ugly view of the South as was seen in the classic To Kill a Mockingbird. I never saw that as ugly. It was just realistic. For a while, because of segregation, the South was demonized. Listen to this language, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
The South was demonized because of segregation. It was portrayed as something akin to a third world nation or even Hitler's Third Reich. But are any of these portrayals of the South accurate? What was the South really like? Why such stark portrayals of the South? And then she asks me if I want to have on this guy who wrote this book and this author can discuss in detail what life in the South was like and why it's been portrayed in so many different ways. I can say revisionism. Can you say revisionism?
Yeah. You know, to me, the bottom line was the same thing you'll see in modern society is the cheapest labor people can get. And if it involves whether it's wage slavery or lifetime slavery, the motive is the same. Give me that money. And because there was a lot of white indentured servants that came over here and got worked around.
And died.
Yeah.
Because as Charles C. Mann points out in 1493, and I hope people went and bought and read that book, because it completely changes one's understanding of the settlement pattern of the European arrival here and the African arrival here and what Dr. John mentioned earlier, the Columbian Exchange. The importation of African and the creation of African slavery here had a lot to do with the fact that once the mosquito got here, life became intolerable, and white folks and native folks died like flies. You know, there was that word out there to be seasoned. One had to survive for a year or two here, and if you survived the first couple of years and you got over your dose of malaria or yellow fever, well, you'd probably make it. But a lot of people didn't.
One credit I can give to the hospital in Washington, the big army hospital.
Walter Reed.
I believe he worked on isolating the malarial mosquito. I think he was involved with that.
Yeah, he was an African-American doctor.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly.
But as I say, what do you say to people when they... You just came back from Germany... And you've seen the rise of something over there you didn't like.
No, it's frightening.
Yeah. I mean, it keeps coming back. I sent you a thing about a new cell phone. Did you see that?
Yes, I did. I laughed. I laughed.
European parodists really can hit hard with that stuff. But I won't keep you, but I don't know how to deal with this buddy of mine. It's like the first meeting we had when we were in the eighth grade, I beat the crap out of him, and we became friends after that. But I'm getting to the point where maybe I have one more shot left in me to go upside some asshole's head, you know?
I understand.
I saw film of those.
Well, but when somebody when you're trying to make a cogent argument and someone responds with, well, that's irrelevant, that means that they've lost.
Well, he was on a debate team in college. So what? Come out to the neighborhood bar where I was with a bunch of college students and sit and debate politics, buddy.
Yeah.
You know, he never served in the armed forces, but he was, you know, he was happy not to. He pulled other stunts instead of protesting the war.
Sure, just like the Willard of Oz.
Yes. Yes, the Willard of Oz. I love that one.
Yeah, don't you? I mean, I can't use that enough.
And this guy in Massachusetts, this Brown, I got to look at those guys. They look exactly like the jerks that used to come into this. When you play bars on college campuses, you got a lot of people like these guys. They had gone through life with doing whatever the hell they wanted to do. And then they came into that place where the big bouncer was a door gunner and Nam, and the other two guys, the two other guys who had done time as guests of the state and were iron workers, and these kids wondered why they got the crap beat out of them.
Well, let me just tell you, this is how it is.
That's the thing, and it really angers me. I still have that.
Isn't that the same impulse that drives all of the you people statements from the bishop's wife?
Yes.
Our buddy Ron in Raleigh noted, Bill, he said, last night wasn't the first time she wiggled into some leather. First she put the lotion on her skin, and then she wiggles in. Oh!
Oh, you hit something on, you know, that Tehran hostage crisis. The owner of this one bar that I work for, his brother-in-law was working for the diplomatic corps, and he was a hostage. That's how small this world is sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
And it's funny, because this guy, the husband, my bud, the guy that owned the place, he had stood next to, at a college, and that one state over from you guys, you know, the one that they sang the song about in the Civil War?
Yes.
And he stood
Carry Me Back to, or My Old Home, or...
Yeah, well, this guy was a defensive end, and the guy he stood next to for at least 2 years was Randy White.
So
this is how small a world it is, and I'm sure you've seen even more because you were out and about. I got a kick out of the Fighting Bob thing. Some of that singing I heard, I had napped off, and when I woke up, I said, "What year is this?" You know, some of songs were things I had kind of heard many years ago.
I love the Fighting Grannies.
Oh, well, it's about time that we stand up to these people because what was it? Malloy was reading the platform, the beginning of the platform of the Republican Party in the 56 election. And as he was reading it, you said, "Well, yeah, I could live with this. I could get along with this." And they've gone so far away from this that it scares the living crap out of them.
Well, no, that's what blew my mind about what I saw in Germany, Bill. It was the fact that all of these neo-Nazi stickers that were all over little light poles in little towns Germany, once you translated them into English, they read like the 2012 Republican Party platform blanks.
Oh, good, yes. I'll let you go.
Unser Land in unserer Hand. Our land in our hands. Good guests come, but good guests leave. You know,
well,
come
I
on.
Know there's always been hostility against the Turkish laborers that they had to bring in there because they were short of men. Gee, I wonder why there was...
Yeah, you know, the occasional world war.
It'll do that to you.
Yeah.
But I'll remind you one thing. If you get on a plane... let him have the window seat. Anyway, I'll talk to you, Bob.
All right, we'll see you, Bill. Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress from Cleveland, legendary bluesman there. Rod in Raleigh has come up with this thing, and we get it periodically, and I love it because he's just he's juxtaposing what the horn sounds like versus what right-wing radio sounds like. So the latest installment in Can't Imagine It on right-wing radio. He said, discussions like these tonight always take me to an interesting place. My friends, today on the EIB Network, the Excellence in Broadcasting Network, behind with my formerly nicotine-stained fingers from behind the golden EIB microphone, we'll be discussing pre-Columbian North America and the rise of Indian civilization. Yeah, see, I don't see that happening on the EIB either. Ron does note, though, he also notes, he says, I'm with Jim. Bob, I know you're a skeptic on the subject of UFOs, and I understand that position. The thing about me is that I've talked to too many people, including a pilot with the Air Force that had the same job as Slim Pickens and Dr. Strangelove. These guys aren't prone to hyperbole. He sends me a link. He says, the link is to an incident that has been very, very well documented. Please pay particular attention to the size of the craft that was witnessed and try to wrap your head around seeing something of that magnitude flying would affect you. And then P.S., the South was all Mai Tais and Yahtzee, Bob. Frisbees and wheat checks for everyone. Kate writing in says, hello to the listeners tonight. We've been blessed with some of the best conversation from at least three callers who could be considered national treasures. Please hit the PayPal button for $5 or $10 tonight to keep it going. Thank you to Horst. He says it much better and more gently than I. Thank you, Kate. This in from Andy. He says, regarding your knowledge of ancient Indian culture, have you heard about the theory that the Indians traded with Europe? It was either the Discovery Channel or National Geographic that tracked trade with Europe from the eastern seaboard of North America. The ancient North American Indians supposedly had arrowheads and spearheads that could have come from only one quarry now in France. These spear and arrowheads were found up and down the East Coast in small hidden storage cavities in caves or underground. Know anything about this? Actually, no. I don't. It'll bear some digging around. The spear and arrowheads would have come from travelers through the frozen islands from modern France through Scandinavia, across the frozen islands linking modern-day Iceland and Greenland down through Canada. Again, also, the East Coast Indians supposedly have DNA matching Europeans. I've heard that, and I've also heard modern Native peoples, Indians, calling BS. But Andy says it throws many discoveries of North America into turmoil. Nothing throws North American pre-Columbian prehistory, which in itself is a Eurocentric kind of sleazy word, prehistory. No, they didn't have any history till the white folks got here. Everything is prehistory until we taught them to write. But the ongoing Clovis debate, the Clovis point being sort of the gold standard holy grail, and people saying that the Clovis point is older than what present science suggests. But even though none of this, some of these things may be in flux or unsettled or in a state of reinvestigation, there are still no chariots. There are still no iron blades. There's still no silk. There are still no olive trees. I mean, my God, there weren't any honeybees. There weren't any grapes as we know grapes. There were no apples. It is an entirely different world. But the Book of Mormon says, it was all there. Yeah. So, I mean, I love some of the speculative stuff. I read a couple of the Graham Hancock books, and they're good because they kind of make your mind wonder about things. But I'm also, I'm doggedly evidence-based. I'm particularly fascinated with the legend of Prince Madoc, the Welsh prince who was alleged to have he was one of the bastard sons of Owen Wyneth, and was said to have left war-torn Wales and sailed and wound up at the mouth of Mobile Bay and blah 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 blah. And it's fascinating because several different people documented some of this stuff at the same time that the Lost Tribes of the Children of Israel stuff was going around. Once again, Eurocentric, or old world centric, trying to explain Native practices as based upon contact, with, you know, necessary contact with the civilizing influence of white folks. The story told by, recounted by the first governor of Tennessee, John Sevier, of a conversation he had with old Akonashota, or Akonastota, a Cherokee headman who had said that many generations before the grandfathers had expelled a pale-skinned people calling themselves Welsh from what was then what we would come to know as the Tennessee Valley, the Tennessee River Valley. And that goes on to become the template for the run-ins or the initial meetings with the Mandans, who were later decimated by smallpox and various other Western diseases, and what remnant was left of them was absorbed by a different Mandan band. If you've ever seen A Man Called Horse, you know, there's that horrifying scene. Well, I mean, you know, it was Richard Harris, you know, with the eagle's talons dug into his pectoral muscles and lifted up in the lodge, in the sweat lodge, and, you know, the myth of first man hung up, which white folks naturally assumed was a long-forgotten understanding of the crucifixion story. I love that speculative stuff. But again, there's not a lot of evidence to support it. You know, the real evidence, peer-reviewed stuff like Dr. John was talking about. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Yeah. Hey, Jeremy, how you doing?
Hey, I called because Kate and Jim inspired me. I stand with them in terms of, and I stand with you to the extent that I think that human beings probably did a lot of our own stuff, but I do believe at some point we had some sort of inspiration or, shall we say, help from another species of some sort saying, hey, you could do it better if you did it this way. Not that they necessarily did it, but I think they helped us in a couple of ways. Maybe pyramids, you know, the stone being so close together. But also, I want to throw this out there for food for thought. I'm sure Jim has probably heard it, maybe even Kate has, maybe you have. About, let's say it was probably the latter part of last year, there's an organization called MUFON. I believe that's the Mutual UFO Network or something like that.
I think I've heard of that organization.
Yeah, they're real famous. They document things and things that have happened. But anyway, they filed something under the Freedom of Information Act with the Obama administration. Basically, they're asking for more information on what the government knew about otherworldly happenings and this and that. Well, they got to a certain level of signatures where the government had agreed to do something, and once they did that, President Obama came out, and he said, okay, well, you made it to there. If you make it to just this number of signatures more, we'll tell you everything we know. They did it. In the very time they did it, the Obama administration came out and said, we know nothing. We told you all we already know. The fact that our government toys with us with things like this, I think, leads to a lot of speculation and probably that they know more than they want to talk about. Not because they're afraid of it, probably because they're afraid, any government's afraid to look inferior, like they couldn't protect or stop these things from happening.
And again, I find that stuff fascinating, Jeremy, but you do understand my position. That, you know, being rooted in science, or trying to be rooted in science and documentation and the scientific method, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Well, no, you know, I completely agree, but I'm just throwing a couple of these things out here. And one more. This year, a good portion of Project Blue Book is stated to come out of declassification because it's past its 6-year period, so more light may be shed on some of these subjects. But I just thought I would put some of that stuff out there.
Cause sure,
I share all the ideas, but I probably believe more with Jim and Kate than anything, honestly. And I board that ship with my cats, too.
Okay. This sounds good, Jeremy.
Thanks, Bob.
You take care. Bye now.
Yeah, bye.
And from that comes the observation, you know, from Shakespeare's Hamlet that there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophies. And there may be. There may be. Jim, let me see. Jim wanted me to Google something and play it for Kate. I can't, Jim, because my this tired old computer is tottering along, and it will not tolerate me opening another tab. If this was on video, you would see me sitting here making obscene gestures at the computer for not cooperating as I try to go from story to story to story. It is about, 13 minutes before the hour. It is prayer meeting, and I'm gonna save some of the stuff that I wanted to work into tonight. It seems it'll fit more properly on Thorn in the Side Thursday. But there's one story that I gotta get to. Just gotta. I got this in email just a few minutes ago. And I want to bring this out simply because I think it's important to note that while the right wing, people like Pamela Geller, are thinking, in a battle between civilized man and a savage, side with the civilized man. Okay, well, now shall we get down to the dirty business of defining civilized? Because this is one of those uncivilized moments. Anyone who has ever been a part of the U.S. Armed Forces, especially in a combat zone, will understand how little things can become really big things in a hurry, and they can be deadly. Now, this story goes back to 2010, January 2010 in particular, and I remember talking about it on the air, when word of the so-called Jesus rifle came to light. There are scopes manufactured by a company called Trigicon that are put on military rifles. Trigicon has probably gotten a huge contract to do this. Trigicon happens to be run by a bunch of religiously insane evangelical fundamentalists. It was 2010 when the Jesus rifle was discovered. Trigicon had been putting serial numbers on their scopes that contained at the end of the serial number a reference to a Bible verse. And I guess it's not just on the scope, it's on the M4 rifle. They've used verses from Revelations. They've used rifles from Matthew, Mark, Luke, Corinthians. There's a photograph of the story I'm looking at that the serial number ends with JN8:12, which is evangelical code for John 8:12. For those of you who don't want to be bothered running off to Bible.com or something, John 8:12 is: "Then spake Jesus again unto them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." Michigan-based manufacturer Trigicon made 250,000 of these things. It was discovered in 2010. In 2010, the Pentagon ordered the removal of the Jesus rifle code. It is 3 years later. The Jesus code is still on the rifles, and they are being deployed to our, they're being dispersed to our troops in Afghanistan. The code is on the Advanced Combat Optical Gun Sight. And don't think for a minute that the Afghans, whose country we are occupying, won't find out quickly that we're carrying Crusader rifles. I mean, really, consider, I'm the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. And what? And the light of life is actually going to be the light of death because it's going to be the muzzle flash from this M4 rifle? Cover me. All right, I got the light of life here. Blam, 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 blam. Die, die, Haji, die. Blam.
blam, 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 blam. I got your light of life right here, you raghead. Blam, 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 blam.
I feel for and fear for every member of our military that under orders has to carry one of these godforsaken weapons. It is bad enough that we are over there. It is worse that some evangelical bunch of fundamentalists who are trying to set the world on fire so Jesus will come back wants to make sure that our troops on the ground in places like Afghanistan are understood by the people whom they are occupying to be crusaders. The story comes from NBC News. A story by Kerry Hoos. But right, the Muslims are the crazy fundamentalist, the enraged, inflamed. Right. Your tax dollars, which you probably object to being having used in warfare anyway, your tax dollars were used to purchase guns that the manufacturer, with no input, in violation of the Constitution and no small number of federal statutes, imbued with New Testament Bible verses for a war against people of a very much different faith. An officer speaking on condition of anonymity said, "Do all the Afghans and Taliban know about this? Probably not, but the ones who do could ultimately affect the life of a soldier. There's absolutely no reason this couldn't have been done in the first 6 weeks, and that just leads me to wonder, why is the Army leadership not taking ownership of the responsibility of completing this task?" I'm sorry, that was Mikey Weinstein from the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. Meanwhile, an unknown, undisclosed member of the military provided a photograph to show that, yes, these weapons are still going out. That anonymous officer said, "I honestly believe that this is a dangerous situation. It literally could be a matter of life and death for a soldier if he fell into the wrong hands. The fact that combatant commanders are not following rules set by Department of Defense commanders is very disturbing to me. I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." My God, what kind of a bloodthirsty monster does that? Again, this is allegedly the Holy Scripture of these evangelicals' religion. I mean, what's one of the other verses? "Lo, I come with a sword." But any way you slice it, you can't get away from the fact that Jesus was about not killing people as opposed to slaughtering them. And if your country is being occupied and you find out about this, try to take, you know, never mind walk a mile in the shoes of, try to take two or three steps in the shoes of someone who is being occupied by a foreign power, the greatest allegedly foreign power on earth. And even their weapons bear religious proselytization. I'm sure I wonder if anybody at Trigicon ever told them about belt plates of soldiers marching off to a massive worldwide conflagration with the inscription on their belt buckles that said, "Gott mit uns." God with us. Nah, probably not. You know, because this is different. Yeah, we really do love Jesus. We love him so much that we're going to reference the Prince of Peace on the rifles we're going to use to slaughter the heathen Muslims. Infidels! Infidels!